Heli Kesser Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HeliKesserJane.com.
Did these guys understand the danger they were in? Do you think State understood just how dangerous the situation was? And while I'm going there, you and I talked off air about the fact that I covered the first embassy death of an American diplomat in Guatemala, and that was back in 1971. I covered it a few years later for different reasons. Nothing seems to have changed. Let's go there.
That is one of the big takeaway messages here, and you're right. And we talked about this, Hallie, and I did not set out to write a political book, and I am not in that business. I was out as a journalist to tell the story of what happened that night. But it's inescapable that a lot of the lessons of the things that had happened prior, whether in Guatemala or in Beirut or in Dar es Salaam, where American diplomats came under attack, we didn't learn the lessons. And we all know the old rule that those who fail to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat it. And that was clear here. And so to answer your question, yes, this was a repetition of events from the past. Having said that, the guys who were there to guard the CIA annex, I think, had a crystal clear understanding of just how dangerous it was.
Ah, questions. So many questions. Hours and hours and hours of questions concerning that sad night, September 11, 2012, when so many valiant American lives were lost in Benghazi, Libya. Just ask former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about questions. But can we ever ask too many questions? Questions lead to answers, not always the ones we want to hear. Often, however, answers we need to know. Today on the Heli Kesser Jane Show, answers via journalist Mitchell Zukov from the perspective of the surviving members of the security team who fought the valiant fight in Benghazi, as told in Mr. Zukov's best-selling book, now the film directed by Michael Bay and causing all sorts of controversy, 13 Hours. Hi, and welcome. Thank you so much for being here. I am your host, Heli Kesser Jane. But before we begin, today, the Heli Kesser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HeliKesserJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And remember, the Heli Kesser Jane Show is always available online at HeliKesserJane.com and a host of venues, including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, iHeartRadio, and on our home network, Blog Talk Radio. Hello, I'm Heli Kesser Jane, host of the Heli Kesser Jane Show. Join me Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern when I talk with the great artists, writers, musicians, politicians, and celebrities of our day. The Heli Kesser Jane Show is talk radio for fine minds. Tune in live or listen to the podcast at HeliKesserJane.com. Best-selling author Mitchell Zukov is a professor of journalism at Boston University. His books include Frozen in Time, an epic story of survival about a U.S. military airplane that crashed on the Greenland Glacier during World War II, the subsequent hunt for the plane, and Zukov's own role in helping to find the plane buried in the ice decades later and lost in Shangri-La. Zukov received a master's degree from the University of Missouri and was a Batten Fellow at the Darden School of Business Administration at the University of Virginia. Zukov's magazine work has appeared in The New Yorker, Fortune, and elsewhere. In 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi, co-written with the surviving American security operators who fought that fateful night in the 2012 attack by Islamic militants on the U.S. State Department Special Mission Compound and a nearby CIA station called the Annex in Benghazi, Libya. Now, by the way, the basis for the new blockbuster Michael Bay film of the same name,
Zukav recounts the actual events and offers a step-by-step look at how they unfolded. The account in 13 Hours is not about what officials in the U.S. government knew, said, or did before or after the attack, but is instead about the 13-hour Benghazi incident from the perspective of the surviving members of the security team who were involved in the fighting. Let's talk. So, Mitch, I am so glad that you took this one on, right? Really? I've had my own experience with this kind of thing. I'm glad that you were the one who did this. How did you get to these guys, or did they get to you? How did this all come together?
Well, they actually got to me. I appreciate you saying that, because there were definitely people who sort of said, you know, you've got to be crazy to take this on. Because of all the politics and everything else that was swirling around Benghazi. But I got a call one day, about a year and a half ago, from, you know, folks in publishing saying, look, these guys who were actually there on the ground that night, who had, fought and tragically lost a couple of their brothers, and then also certainly lost the ambassador and the communications aide, Sean Smith, they stuck together and they wanted to tell the story one time. And they wanted to tell it together as accurately as possible. And did I want to meet them? And what journalist wouldn't? And so fortunately, they agreed that I was the right person to tell the story. And we went to work.
So before getting into the weeds of this event, let's get some background here. September 11th, 2012, the American Embassy complex in Benghazi. What was the political situation in Libya? And let me say before I go there with you that I think a lot of people think they know this story. I really don't think that they do. And I think that's why your book is so important. So let's go there.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that very much. And in fact, that's why I opened the book the way I do, because people have to understand the larger climate. This is the early months of the post-Gaddafi era. And at that moment, Libya is effectively an ungoverned state. There is no functioning government. There's no functioning real infrastructure. And certainly in the eastern part of the country, in Benghazi, it's particularly unsettled. The Benghazi was the cradle of the revolution, and so the people who were rebels one day, who wanted to unseat Gaddafi and succeeded, obviously, then sort of were trying to figure out what came next, what role would they have in a future of Libya, and a certain number of them arranged themselves in militias. And they were armed heavily. Once they gained access to the stockpiles of weapons that Gaddafi had, this was suddenly, gun ownership, individual gun ownership had been illegal for 40 years in Libya. But after Gaddafi fell, it seemed everyone had access to a gun and large guns. And, if they didn't have access, they could go to basically an open air market where, you know, at one stand they're selling chickens and next stand they're selling, rocket launch grenades. And so this is the world in which, you know, we're trying to operate a diplomatic compound. And as I say, a lot of these guys arranged themselves in militias, and some were extremist and some were Islamist, aligned at least ideologically with Al-Qaeda. So it was a very, very scary place at that time.
I think that's so important, because people don't get a feeling of what went down. I mean, 'cause that story about when they brought down Gaddafi, that's kind of gray in journalism. Also, give me a brief synopsis of what went down that night at the compound.
Sure. Well, you know, if you don't mind, I actually loved it to start the story that morning, because the first signs of trouble came just after dawn. And at the diplomatic compound, there were some local Libyan guards who had been hired to keep watch, and maybe, as the guys who I worked with say, at least be a speed bump if trouble happened. And they noticed that someone in a Libyan policeman's uniform had gone up to the second floor of a building under construction across from the diplomatic compound, and was taking either photos or videos over the wall into where the ambassador was. And, you know, he was only there visiting. He was normally based in Tripoli at a much more secure facility, but he was there on a brief 5-day visit to Benghazi. And suddenly we have somebody doing either surveillance or reconnaissance with a video, with a camera, with a cell camera. And when the person was confronted by this Libyan guard who was hired by the Americans, he took off. He got in his car and left, but of course he took his images with him. And so that set off some alarms, but, you know, nothing too dramatic. The ambassador and his aides were drafting a letter to complain to the the police department in Benghazi. But other than that, you know, the ambassador went about his business. The one thing he did do wisely was to stay inside the walls of the compound. Remember, it was September 11th. And as unsettled a place like Benghazi, you didn't want to give opportunity to anyone to have the ambassador driving around town. And so the day was routine. He saw a number of visitors. It was quiet in Benghazi that day. There were no protests as there were in some other cities like Cairo and elsewhere about a video or about other things. In fact, after dark, the ambassador, as it got dark, he was able to walk outside the front walls of the embassy, of the diplomatic compound to say goodnight to his last visitor, a Turkish envoy. And he returned inside the compound, went into his villa, the main building inside this compound, and was in his room, writing in his diary, getting ready for bed, as was in another room in the villa, with Sean Smith, the communications aide, and the five members of the diplomatic security staff who were there with him were relaxing. They thought the day was over. Three were sitting out by the pool. One was inside the villa watching television, and the fifth was inside the tactical operations center doing paperwork. When he heard a noise, he heard what sounded like gunfire, which wasn't uncommon, certainly in Benghazi in the summer of 2012, but it sounded closer than he expected. He looked up, his name's Alec, and Alec looked up and looked at the video monitor and saw men rushing onto the compound through the open front gate. And they were armed, perhaps two dozen of them in that first look he got. And they were armed with AK-47s, and they were firing them off, and they were setting fires, and they grabbed jerry cans filled with diesel fuel, and they started setting fire and breaking into the diplomatic villa where the ambassador and Sean Smith were. And almost immediately, the five diplomatic security agents, the guards, the Americans were overwhelmed. They were separated into three different buildings. One remained in that operations center. One was in the villa with the ambassador and Sean Smith. And the other three were in the cantina, another building on the property. And they were not armed with their long guns or their body armor, and so they had to fetch them from their rooms, and by the time they did that, they were in a defensive posture, and they couldn't do anything but wait. And so the call goes out. There's a second compound in Benghazi, a secret compound operated by the CIA, and it's known as the Annex. And it was a much harder target, and it was well-staffed and well-guarded, frankly, by the six men who were members of what was called the Global Response Staff. And the Global Response Staff was a security team, former Navy SEALs, former Army Rangers, Marines, who were hired to protect the CIA case officers who were gathering intelligence. And these guys, collectively, the six, this team had about 100 years of military experience and contracting experience among them. And they, as they call it, they jocked up. They always are within a very, very short distance of their long guns and their night vision goggles and their armor. And they assembled out two staged vehicles, two armored vehicles, and were ready to go. And this is where it becomes something of a dispute, as you know. Mm-hmm. There's no dispute. They were told to wait. They say they were told to stand down. And I find them incredibly, completely credible. And they were clearly held from going. And the ostensible reason was that the base chief, the CIA base chief, a man we identify only as Bob because he's an intelligence agent, was trying to rally support from one of the militias who were believed to be friendly and had agreed to help the Americans. This may have been what he was doing. I can't contradict that. That's the official report. It just has never made sense to me, and it certainly never made sense to the guys who I wrote 13 hours with.
But before we go into that, let me put you on hold for a second.
Sure.
No, that's fine, because what I think what we want to do is let's establish something here, because I think this is something that isn't clear, and that is this. first of all, let me say this. You did not want to write a political book. That you want to put out the facts. So that's where we're going,
correct.
Okay, is into the facts. But I want to establish with you this. In the embassy, who in this compound, who is in charge? Is it the ambassador who's in charge in a state like this? Is it the CIA base operative, the guy we call Bob in your book? Is it Washington? What's the protocol here? And I'm asking this because even in Homeland, it's confusing. Who has the bottom? Who's got the bottom line say?
It's a great question, and it's a complicated answer. The short version is the diplomatic compound. You know, this is a State Department compound. And the principal officer, as he is known, is responsible for on-the-ground decisions, certainly in consultation, perhaps, you know, when possible, with Tripoli or with Washington. At that moment, the ambassador was the chief operating officer, if you will, of the diplomatic compound. Completely separate, a half mile away or less than a mile away at the CIA annex, the base chief, Bob, who is not a military officer, although this was a military situation at this moment, he is the man in charge. Now, certainly, we all have worked in hierarchies where he is not the end-all, be-all end-all. He's not the director of the CIA, certainly. So if he were given orders, he would have to follow them. By all reports, he was making the decisions. Bob was making the decisions on the ground there for the CIA and the security team, the guys I worked with. And there were very few decisions, frankly, to be made over at the diplomatic compound because by the time anybody knew what was happening, the compound was completely overrun. So the ambassador was making calls for help in the burning villa out to Tripoli, and he did reach the folks in Tripoli, his associates in Tripoli, and the men, the diplomatic security team, were in touch with Tripoli and I believe Washington as well, from a security standpoint. And they're, rather than making decisions, frankly, again, at the diplomatic compound, they were simply calling for help. They were explaining the situation, and they were asking for, you know, one radio call that I report in the book. Is a call that goes out, frankly, to the annex, to the guys I worked with, and that if you don't get here, we're going to die. And that was the basic tenor of the calls that were emanating from the diplomatic compound.
It is fascinating there that you could, because I think what we're going to establish is one thing in the mass confusion in this thing, which we'll get
correct.
To. So things are tense in Libya. Let's go back there. Did these guys understand the danger they were in? Do you think state understood just how dangerous the situation is? And while I'm going there, you and I talked off air about the fact that I covered the first embassy death of an American diplomat in Guatemala.
Yes.
And that was back in 1971. I covered it a few years later for different reasons. Nothing seems to have changed. Let's go there.
That is one of the big takeaway messages here, and you're right. And we talked about this, Hallie, and I did not set out to write a political book, and I am not in that business. I was out to as a journalist tell the story of what happened that night. But it's inescapable that a lot of the lessons of the things that had happened prior, whether in Guatemala or in Beirut or in Dar es Salaam, where American diplomats came under attack. We didn't learn the lessons, and we all know the old rule that those who fail to learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat it. And that was clear here. And so to answer your question, yes, these things, this was a repetition of events from the past. Having said that, the guys who were there to guard the CIA annex, I think had a crystal clear understanding of just how dangerous it was. They were constantly on high alert. They were fully aware that they were surrounded by people who they simply couldn't trust and who, if given the opportunity, some of them at least would certainly see an American ambassador or so see Americans in their midst as, you know, as a pelt worth hanging on their wall. And so the guys, as security experts, and again, these guys have been doing this for years and years, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in a number of other places, a couple of them had spent quite a bit of time in Libya. They knew what they were facing.
Did they voice those concerns, though, that things might not have been as well protected as they might be? Were they aware that there were holes in the system that maybe they...
Absolutely.
Okay, so talk about
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I'm certain of it, and I can prove it. In the weeks prior to the September 11, 2012 attack, the guys from the CIA Annex security team held drills, and in fact, held drills on the diplomatic compound or with the diplomatic compound to prepare for these kinds of attacks. They were constantly talking among themselves and even talking to the diplomatic security agents saying, you know, you guys are vulnerable. This is a soft target. And so they ran medical drills. They ran response drills. They were not responsible for hardening the diplomatic compound. They were responsible for hardening the CIA annex, and they did so. They staged weapons on the roof. They staged ammunition on the roofs of the four main buildings on the CIA annex. They had fighting towers, as they called them, at the walls of these of the annex. They had a very clear plan in place as to who would be where if and when they came under attack. And so even just between the two compounds, you could see a vast difference in the security posture. These guys absolutely understood. They told people about it, and frankly, they weren't listened to. And I must add, it was clear that Ambassador Stevens understood that there were security risks here. He requested that a military security team that was offered by the Defense Department remain in Libya through the summer of 2012, during the elections and other things that were going on. The Department of Defense, and this is all established fact, nobody on either side of the aisle has any dispute with these points. The State Department said, we don't think that's necessary. We feel as though our diplomatic security agents have the ability to provide the necessary protection. And so even when the head of the Africa Command, General Ham, personally asked Chris Stevens, Ambassador Stevens, would you like the site security team to remain? Chris Stevens said, well, it's been decided above the chain that they are not necessary. But clearly, by virtue of the fact that more than once he made the request early in the months of 2012, it was clear he was worried about the deteriorating security situation in Libya, throughout Libya.
So I think that's important to establish. Let's go back. Let's go back to,
sure.
Okay, here we are. It's going down. They're told not once, but I think it's twice, right, to stand down.
Even three times.
Even three times. And
wait, stand down, wait.
Yes. Stand down, wait. And then what? I mean, what's the story here? And the Bob ordered
Bob ordered this stand down.
Okay.
And there's no question about that. And it's been explained in a number of reports, most recently in the House Intelligence Committee report, that this was a tactical decision on his part, made by him alone, with no outside influence. And he was making the judgment that they could perhaps get some help from the 17 February Martyrs Brigade, this ostensibly friendly militia. And so he told the guys, don't go. And I think there's no question, and this isn't just hindsight. The guys felt at the time they were losing the initiative. They told him, they told their team leader, we are losing the initiative. We are giving our enemies a chance. And they're on the same radio frequencies as the diplomatic compound. So they're hearing people call out, we're on fire, we're taking fire. And they're, of course, aware how vulnerable they've been on that compound. They've warned how vulnerable that situation is. And they are fuming, and they're frightened, frankly, for the men, the other Americans they'd like to protect. And also, they're frightened to some extent. These guys, shouldn't use the word frightened,
right,
but they're concerned. These guys don't get frightened, but they're concerned for themselves. They know that their task is going to be that much harder. They're going to have to go in against a more entrenched enemy. The longer you wait, the more opportunity your enemy has to build up its defenses, to create a perimeter. And so the minutes are ticking by, and when they hear that call that I mentioned earlier, if you don't get here, we're going to die, they broke command. They violated command. They did something that none of them had ever done in their military or contracting careers, and they pulled out without the order to do so, because they knew that they, you know, if they didn't, any chance of saving the ambassador and anyone else there would be eliminated.
Okay, so let's go for a second. All right, let's go to Washington for a second, because there are all sorts of, you know, reports that it was Washington that was behind the stand down. What'd you come up with?
I have no evidence of that. I play very close to the ground here, and I have no evidence that Bob was not making this decision. I mean, we know he was in consultation with AAA, and there was an open line to Washington. But I can't say, and I won't say what I can't prove.
So, and then let me take you down this rat hole. They stood down for 30 minutes, I think it was, right? Until they decided we can't do that and we're going to be insubordinate. What was it that finally got them to say, enough, we've got to go ahead? What do you think that was? What did they say it was?
I think it really was the radio calls. They knew these guys who were holed up in the various buildings on the diplomatic compound. They had affection for these guys. They liked these guys. They had worked with these guys, and the repeated calls for help, and the idea that there are buildings burning, there's an ambassador and a civilian aide, a State Department aide on the property in danger. They had just reached a breaking point where they said, not that they would be subject, but court-martial us later. We're going. We have to go. And I can't say it was one thing. I think it was just sort of this collective knowledge that this is what we do and this is what we have to do. And I think it should be apparent. I have tremendous admiration for these guys and what the situation they put themselves in. It was not their job. Their job was not to protect the ambassador or to protect the diplomatic security guys. Their job was, as hired contractors, to protect the CIA base. And they were doing that. But that's not how these guys roll.
A couple of things come to mind here. For one, let's look at an opposite to all of this. For 30 minutes, they listened and they did what they were supposed to do. Did they beat themselves up for listening?
That's a great question. I don't think so. I think, you know, maybe privately in some of their quiet moments, perhaps they wish they had gone earlier. But these are military guys, and it's a lot to violate a direct order. And they went as soon as they felt they had to. Certainly they wish, but, you know, rather than beating themselves up, frankly, they're focused more on Bob. They're focused on their commanding officer, who was not a military man, not trained or, I would argue, equipped to make these kind of calls. This is a live fire situation. These are, you know, active militants engaged, in a battle. And you had a commander who was an intelligence officer, whose job is to, you know, and I respect intelligence officers, but their job is to be in the shadows. The job is not to command men in the field of fire. And so whatever decision he made, and even if he said he made it for the right reasons, I think he was, you know, he should have listened to the guys who collectively had these 100 years of experience, a couple of Navy SEALs, our Army Ranger, intelligence officers for the Army, not for the CIA.
You know, I have to say something, stop you there, because you make a point that I think is very brilliant and maybe one that, you know, suggests to state. Stop having these compounds ruled by people who don't understand the military aspects of defense.
I appreciate that, because that absolutely has to be a takeaway, that expertise really counts. And in crisis situations, we need a chain of command who's equipped to respond to the issues at hand. I don't pretend to be. I've spent 30 years as a journalist, not as an intelligence officer, not as a military officer. But at that moment, when you have, and especially, frankly, look, we have 275 or so embassies and compounds and consulates around the world, and a certain number of them are classified as high risk. And in those situations where you have military dangers, I sure as heck want a military person making a decision in terms of how we react and respond.
A long-standing problem with state, between state and defense, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you know,
exactly.
It's the same old, it gets into government. Contractors versus military, I just want to spend a second on this, because
sure.
There have been reports about that, that maybe some of the problems that we're having have to do with the fact that we don't have the same kind of military as we used to when these contractors are coming in. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, I can only speak to these guys. I'm not an expert on military contracting, and I know there have been problems. We all know. Obviously, you know, we focus on the cases like the Blackwater convictions that just took place in manslaughter and worse. But I got to tell you, I have such admiration for these guys. These guys are such professionals. I don't know how different it would have been if they had been six active duty military, if they had been six Delta Force members versus six of these guys, because they responded and they had endless number of decisions to make. And I would argue that at every point in these 13 hours of this night, they made the correct decision. And, you know, as much as we focus understandably and appropriately on the loss of four Americans that night, there's no question in my mind, and I think even to the credit of the House Intelligence Committee's report, which some of which, you know, the guys take issue with, these guys were heroes. They rescued perhaps two dozen Americans that night who, I think in any fair estimation, those two dozen would be gone, would be dead, were it not for these guys and how they responded.
I want to bring up one thing that I don't remember where I read this. It could have been in your book. I don't remember. Bob had a history of this two stand down kind of thing, didn't he?
That is indeed in my book.
Thank you. I read so much in the last few days, I can't remember what came from where.
A couple of months before September 11, 2012, an incident took place where one of the guys who was there that night, Tyrone Roan Woods, and another contractor, another operator, went to the airport in Benghazi to retrieve some cargo. And they were driving back, and they were confronted by a hostile militia and who held them up at gunpoint and was trying to hold them up at gunpoint. And as I say in the book, Roan declined the offer to be robbed. Roan was not the kind of guy who was going to just lay down and say, sure, take what you want. And so, but he was able, he and his the partner he was with at the moment were able to radio back to the annex and say, hey, we're in a gunpoint confrontation here. This is about to get ugly. We need some help. And Bob, at that point, also told the guys immediately were rushing to get out to help Roan, and they were told to wait. They were told to stand down. They were told, don't do anything. We're going to call this friendly militia that we know to go help him. Now, of course, that same friendly militia, and I put quotes around friendly, didn't respond then. They didn't come to Roan's aid. They didn't come to the other contractor's aid. And fortunately, maybe because the militia knew that Roan was going to, you know, take as many of them as he could with him, they backed down. They let him pass. But it was only because, you know, maybe good fortune and a good bluff by Roan that they weren't killed that day. And their materials, their supplies weren't taken. So if that doesn't suggest that, hey, why are we responding? Why are we counting on a militia this night that wouldn't go help us in a daylight moment before shots were fired? Why do we think the same militia, the 17th February Martyrs Brigade, is going to go to the CIA, to the diplomatic compound that is at night on fire, under fire? It doesn't make sense.
And I bring up that point in lieu of the House and Senate Intelligence Committee reviews of Benghazi that seemed to determine that there was no stand-down order preventing officers on the ground from rendering aid, right? The CIA and state denied there was an order to stand down as well.
Yeah. I understand why you would deny it, but because it was obviously not the right decision. But I just think all evidence is to the contrary. And again, and even if we don't get lost in semantics, they do acknowledge that the guys were told to wait and there was a delay. And you know, stand down has become certainly in the context of Benghazi a heightened, phrase, and a loaded phrase. But whether we call it a stand down or we call it a wait, frankly, I believe my guys, when they tell me they were told face to face to stand down, John Tigan, who received that order, you know, has come out publicly. He's using his real name. He's not hiding behind anything to say, I was told to stand down. I was told it more than once. So I believe him. And certainly the evidence suggests they were told to stand down / wait. There's no doubt about that. Everybody agrees. They were told when they were ready to go and wanted to go to aid fellow Americans, they were told not to.
I don't see why they wouldn't have stood down unless somebody told them to. That's the question that I never quite get an answer to.
Great point. That is a great point. That is not how these guys operate.
I mean, it makes no sense. It never did. I always thought this story was a little bit bizarre. Anyway, so 13 hours is a factual account of what happened on September 11th and 2/12 in the Benghazi attack. Based on your exclusive firsthand accounts with the very people who were there on the ground defending the compound. And these guys and you have said that, as I said earlier, you're not interested in politics. But I have to go here with you, Mitch, and that is you knew that once this book was published with what it had in it, that it was going to fuel the flames even more of the story and place blame and back where it deserved to be. So a question some might ask is, and I think it's a fair question, and I'm sure I know your answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Was the need of the operatives to exonerate their reputations more important to them than the scandal their story would inflame, or were they just simply wanting to be guys who felt the story needed to be told by the people who were there?
It's a completely fair question, and I'll sort of answer it directly, but first, I want to make clear, their first motivation, and it was throughout the process, we've worked together and still to this day, was to honor the two men who were members of their team, Tyrone Roan Woods and Glenn Bub Daugherty, who died that night. They also certainly wanted to honor the ambassador Chris Stevens and Sean Smith. And that was the driving force here, that they felt Roan and Bub deserved a story, a true account that wasn't folded into politics or wasn't twisted out of shape about what they did and the heroism that they showed that night in putting themselves in harm's way. The second motivation for them, absolutely, was to tell the story of what they did. And I think that is a human need we all have, because they had heard so many accounts that, you know, several of the guys said to me at various points that people told them, you know, we don't even think there were any security operators on the ground that night. And you guys weren't there. And the guys who saved them was the were the team that came in from Tripoli. And you know, these guys are, you know, to greater or lesser extent, you know, they're all the different guys. These guys respect history. They've read military history, and they appreciate military history. Several, frankly, when we were working, I referenced Black Hawk Down, which is a book that, you know, that for the first time we understood what happened in the Battle of Mogadishu. And they said, you know, that was important to them, that even if some things made them look bad or some people ended up wanting to drag them through politics or whatever, they felt it was important to put this on the record and get it out once and truthfully.
So four Americans dead, as you said, including the ambassador, Ambassador Stevens, Information Officer Sean Smith, CIA operatives Glenn Daugherty and Tyrone Woods. Clearly, the embassy compound had not been adequately secured. So questions of the adequacy of the CIA's response remain. Did the Obama administration try to cover up its tracks is another question. Is this a political story that we were it not for the fact that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who is obviously the forerunner to be the next president of the United States, but this story had the legs that it has? And now another spin that the Republicans are part of the cover-up, too. I mean, this is just a wild ride. They're all valid rat holes for us to travel down, Mitch. But you, Mr. Zukov, great journalist that you are, you have inserted yourself smack dab in the middle of all of this. So I have to ask you, what is your conclusion?
Oh, boy, it's a fair question, and I'm not dodging. I'm really not. I think my main conclusion is this, that because of all the political machinations and the arguments, I think for the longest time, the real story was overlooked, which is, I don't think, regardless of where you are politically, I don't think anybody can make a credible argument to the contrary. The State Department failed sure that this was a secure location. There were numerous tripwires that should have signaled that this was not a place with this light guard the ambassador should travel. When in June of 2012, when the Brits pull out, and because it's too dangerous, because their ambassador Dominic Asquith is attacked in a car convoy, when a wall is blown open at this very U.S. diplomatic compound in June, when the International Red Cross is attacked, you're talking about a situation where the State Department did not require that the diplomatic compound in Benghazi meet the basic standards that we've all agreed to as a country, the Congress, that the State Department has put into place for its embassies and consulates, because this wasn't officially a consulate. It was allowed to be soft. It didn't have to meet those hardened requirements. That's a scandal. That's horrible, and it cost these men their lives. And so I think we have determined that many of the most scurrilous accusations that followed immediately after 9/11 were simply not true. People accused all kinds of things, accused the Secretary of State and the President of all kinds of things that have been demonstrated to be untrue. And I think that what got lost here was the appropriate focus on State Department security and the lessons that weren't learned. And so, I'm less concerned personally, and it was certainly, as you've said, and I appreciate it, that was not my goal in writing 13 Hours, was to drum up or gin up the political arguments again. But to say, the lessons of this night really remain with us, and because we still have men and women around the world doing America's business, both as intelligence officers and diplomats, in really dangerous places. And the least we can do is provide them with maximum security. And I'm still waiting to be assured that we have.
1971 to 2012, darling, you got a long wait to come. These guys don't seem to want to get it. I have to ask you this in closing. How are they doing today, these boys? I mean, any evidence of PTSD? Have they been accepted back into the fold? Has there been a price to pay? And are they allowed to be the heroes they deserve to be called? Because take the politics out, they did their job.
They did. And they're remarkable guys. And I think they certainly all have moments that are not easy moments. But I would say they're doing extremely well. And I think I'm very happy to say that the three of them who've come out publicly using their names, since the publication of the book have been hailed as heroes and have been embraced. And while there have been certainly moments where people have challenged them or accused them of things, they have done what they did from the first moment the first call came out. They stuck together. They're a five-man support unit for each other. And so I have every confidence that these guys are going to be just fine. And I think in the long run, they will be recognized and appreciated as American heroes.
I've been speaking with Mitchell Zukov, author of the riveting book, 13 Hours, The Inside Account of What Really Happened in Benghazi, by way of 12 books. For more information on Mitchell Zukov, be sure to visit his website at mitchellzukov.com. Hi, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. Did you enjoy the show? I hope so. And I hope that you'll tell your friends about it and help us grow our family. How can you help? That's easy. Share the link to the show with your friends or my show's player. And I would love it even more if you'd recommend they visit my website at HallieKasserJane.com. I look forward to seeing all of you there. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieKasserJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap. Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HallieKasserJane.com.